Welcome to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The term Nepo baby is often used when referring to the children of celebrities who follow in their parents' footsteps into professional acting. However, nepotism isn't just limited to show business. In fact, some family businesses have created in hopes of future generations coming into the fold and taking it over. And with an uncertain job market, some see working in the family business as a form of job security. However, working with family can be both good and bad. Can having a good business sense be inherited, or is it taught by growing up around the family business? Joining us now to talk about family business is Dave Specht, Senior Fellow at the Drucker School of Global Family Business Institute at Claremont University. He's also the author of the book, The Family Business Whisperer. Welcome to All Sides, Dave.
Thanks, Erin. Good to be here.
So how did you become a specialist in family business? What made you decide to go into the business of family business?
Well, long ago, I was in grad school studying finance and tax planning, and I needed one elective class to graduate, Amy. So that class happened to be family business management. And what it did was it blended all the tax and the legal with all the non-financial challenges of generational wealth. And I was immediately hooked because it would never be boring. Every family is unique and every family is a puzzle.
Now, the Drucker School of Management website says the majority of businesses everywhere are family controlled and family managed. Yet most management books and courses deal almost entirely with publicly owned and professionally managed companies. So why is there a disconnect there?
Yeah, so the main disconnect is access to research. It's really challenging for academic researchers to find information on private companies. And so it's easiest for them to opt to the public companies that have to report their data. And so I think it's just, it's not that a certain business is better or worse, it's actually access to the data.
So are you seeing an increasing number of people who are going into family businesses? Are you seeing like family businesses grow and thrive in this economy?
Family businesses are known for being resilient. They're known for being innovative, and they are slow to lay off people in hard times. And they're also there's less bureaucracy in a family business, so the ability to pivot is something that is a strength to family businesses, and I think it's attractive. I would say for college students, many times they want to spread their wings and go do something else, but what we find is oftentimes they leave. They go maybe to a larger city. They have an experience with a boss that doesn't have their same last name. And then they realize that maybe the lifestyle that my parents have created in our town isn't so bad. And so a lot of them do end up returning for many different reasons, many for opportunities that the business provides them, but also some of them return for the lifestyle that the community provides that they grew up in.
Now, I mentioned that disconnect where most management books and courses deal with publicly owned, professionally managed companies. But I mean, some of these family businesses, I was reading up on the names of family businesses, they're big companies. I mean, I'm not just talking about like it's mom and dad and six employees in the back.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the S&P 500, many, many, many of them, of the largest, are family owned, family controlled. Even public companies, many of them are still family controlled. So there is a kind of a misnomer that family businesses are small. Family businesses maybe are not as competitive. It couldn't be farther from the truth.
Yeah. I mean, whenever I think of a family business, I think of, you know, the small donut shop around the corner, or like just a store, maybe like one or two locations. But some of these family businesses are global companies, right?
Yeah. I mean, you talk about Walmart, that's a family controlled company. Yeah. They're not small.
Certainly
they
not.
Have
yeah.
Complexity going yeah. on. Yeah. No, there are many large family businesses, and oftentimes it takes generations to develop a large family, a large business. And many of these families represent patient capital, and they continue to reinvest in themselves. And oftentimes that's how they get to the second and the third and the fourth generation.
Now, you mentioned that it's hard to study family businesses. I read in the Wall Street Journal that they did a study of trying to study family businesses. And the way they had to do it is they had to look at the payroll and look for a business where someone in the owner sphere had the same last name as an employee at a lower level. And but then they had to like eliminate last names like Smith just in case they weren't actually related. So I was like, that's difficult. That's hard. That's why the family businesses aren't studied, I guess, right?
It is. Yeah. I mean, if that's the methodology that we're going to use to find and study family businesses, likely we're not going to get a whole lot of data. And the data that we get, it may not be from, may not be from the largest or the best family businesses.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, I mean, another way to approach it is you'd have to call them all and say, hi, does your kid work there? Right. Which you probably would get mixed results on that as well, of them wanting to be skeptical of why to answer that. Right.
Yeah. I mean, oftentimes these families are private for a reason. They like to be able to make decisions on their own without a lot of public scrutiny. And frankly, they like to be able to change if they need to. And so they are skeptical to people necessarily coming in and studying and getting their fingers, on their business data. But they do need to be studied more, because there are some incredible families that have figured out how to be resilient, how to be innovative in times that others are laying off tons of employees. But some of these families have hung in there. I mean, if you look at COVID, there are so many family businesses that waited and waited and waited before they furloughed employees, simply because there was a deeper relationship. Oftentimes these non-family employees are treated as, kind of adopted in family members. And so I think family businesses are slower to cut ties when things are difficult.
Can you tell me some of the major differences between family-owned companies and those that are publicly traded? You just mentioned one, that deeper relationship. Are there other main differences?
One of the biggest differences is the time horizon for investment. So you look at public companies and how do we measure them? I mean, we'll look at a stock every day and watch the movement. Or at the very least, they're managing quarter to quarter. Their leadership is taught, that every quarter we're going to look at performance. Well, I like to think of these family companies as managing and having the ability to manage quarter century to quarter century. Some of the decisions that they make, would not make sense in this quarter. But if you're making a large capital expenditure, if a family has a 25, a 50 year time horizon, at least in their mind, maybe they'll have to change. It just changes the way that they make, that leadership makes decisions.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about keeping a business in the family with Dave Specht, Senior Fellow at the Drucker School Global Family Business Institute at Claremont University. Did I get that whole title right? That's a lot of...
Yeah, I did.
Okay. You're also the author of the book, The Family Business Whisperer. So when bringing a child into the family business, is it better for the business, or is it better for the offspring? Like, who benefits the most from that? I would assume the child, but I don't know the answer.
It's a great question. So with my students, I like to ask them a question. If I hear that they want to go back to their family business, I ask them the question, is your family business better off for you being there than not? Hmm. And if they can't answer, if they can't square their shoulders and answer that question with a lot of confidence, Amy, I don't think they're ready to return to the family business. So I'm a fan of young people working outside of the family enterprise, so that they know that they can be independently okay, that they can get a paycheck from someone else. This develops their confidence. They also go and get skills that they can then bring back to the family business. So there's some different elements. Obviously, both need to win in that transaction. The business needs to be better off for them being there, but oftentimes the rising generation does have some opportunities and at least access to information and leaders that maybe a non-family member would not.
So should a family member maybe climb the company ladder rather than coming in at the executive level then? Do you feel like that would work as well? If you're going to work in the family business, you might as well start in the back office doing paperwork or in the stock room rather than being immediately an executive.
I think it is a great idea to start at the very bottom. And maybe the main reason, Amy, is to develop the respect of the non-family employees. If you see a family member come back and they're given, the toughest jobs, they're given the most menial jobs to start out with, there's an empathy that gets developed for the non-family employees. And ultimately, those family members that come back are held to an unreasonable standard by those that are not family members. And so they have to work hard to be able to develop their own identity within that family business space. So, I think hiring, an heir as vice president of special projects is a mistake, and it will backfire. I don't think there should be a direct path to, high leadership positions until they're ready, until they have the confidence and courage that, and also the relationships with non-family employees that they're going to have to lead.
And I mean, I guess say you mentioned, like, say you are not sure as a child whether you will help the family business or not. Maybe a lot of maybe some of them go to college, they major in something, and then they have trouble getting a job, and they decide, oh, well, maybe I should go back to the family business. Do you see that from time to time where they try one path and maybe it doesn't work out, or they see the family business as the better opportunity eventually?
Yeah, I mean, I'm 47 years old, Amy. We'll see what happens tomorrow. Like, we're all on this journey of what's next and where do we go from here. So, I think for many families, that especially those family businesses that reach the third generation, what many of them are doing is developing family employment policy statements that basically set the expectation for family members connected to the business on, can they work in the business right away? If they are going to work in the business right away, what sorts of jobs can they get? Will they have to apply for jobs that are open? Will a job be created for them? So a lot of these families, as they get out into the third, second and third generations, have become very intentional with hiring practices for their own kids because they want to set an expectation. If the family really believes that education and work experience is important, that may be in the policy. They may not be eligible for a long-term job at the family company until they've, jumped over these hurdles that have been set by, by the family and the company. So there's quite a bit of thought that goes into it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I guess you wrote a book called The Family Business Whisperer, so I'm assuming you would recommend to a family business to have a plan in writing of how family members can come in and out of the business.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the main challenges that families face is when there is a lack of similar expectations. That's when you start to have challenges. And you nailed it. There needs to be a path into the family business that's clear. Like, how do I get in? And there also needs to be a path out. I like to call this owners by choice rather than owners by force. There needs to be a path out if someone wants to sell. That also needs to be created, and that doesn't happen without great transparency and communication. And some of the best family businesses have done that, and they've put governance structures in place so that they know how to get in, they know how to get out, they know what the expectations are for cash flows and things like that.
I can imagine things get more complicated when you have more than one child working in the family business too. Can you tell me about those complications?
Well, my life is complicated. I have six kids and I don't own a family business. So it's complicated from a family perspective already. And then when you have children, multiple children connected to a family business, it is hard because you may have some that are interested in working in the day-to-day business. You may have others that have different dreams. And so a family will have to choose, how will we force them into shared ownership, or will only those that are operating the business be on a path to ownership? So there's a lot of tough questions that need to be answered, and conversations that need to be had. I call these courageous conversations, Amy.
That would be a courageous conversation, because if you have to work in the family business to own a piece of it, that creates a whole nother level of complexity there, right?
Yeah, one of my favorite questions for families that are considering putting their kids in shared ownership, especially when there's some that are in the business and some that are not, I like to ask all if they would, well, first, the first question is, do you want to inherit some of the family business? And most of the time, the answer is yes.
Yes,
Clearly,
clearly.
Amy, you and I would like to inherit, right?
I would, yeah, find me a family business. I'll jump in.
The second question is almost never asked. Are you willing to inherit the debt that comes along with those assets.
Oh, no, no.
Yeah, it changes the conversation quickly. Yeah. So, you know, we need to be clear about exactly what it means to be an owner. It's not just the good, it's also the challenge, and it's putting yourself at risk. So again, it's all about having these courageous conversations.
Yeah, I could see another courageous conversation being if your child doesn't belong in the family business, like they just don't have the right mindset for it. I mean, I could come up with an example of like a child just doesn't fit what the business does, right? You have to have a courageous conversation then to tell them this isn't the place for you.
Yeah, and I think we need to do more career coaching specifically with families that own businesses, because there may be a sense of guilt if they don't come back, and we need to remove those things. We need to figure out what are the talents of the rising generation. Do they want to apply those talents to the family business? And if not, one of the greatest assets that most family businesses have is their relationships. It's not even their capital. And so when you think about the rising generation, we need to, you know, help the rising generation find their talents. And then if those talents don't line up with the family business, I think it's time to leverage the other assets, you know, those relationships, so that we can help them to chase their dreams, whatever those may be.
Yeah, it's interesting because I did a show completely not related to this topic, but we had a farmer on who was a guest on the show. We were talking about like rural land. And he mentioned that he has two kids and neither of them wanted to go into the family business of farming. And I immediately thought, oh, yeah, okay. I mean, that's something I could see, to not, your kids don't want to be a farmer, but he wanted to keep the business a family business. So it's an interesting dynamic there, whenever you think about wanting to keep it a family business, even if you have kids that don't want the business.
Yeah. And I imagine those kids wanted to inherit the land and want to get some of the cash flow from the ongoing operation of the farm, but maybe it isn't their dream to
run it. Yeah.
To live in the little town and run the farm. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, coming up, we're going to continue to talk about family business with David Specht. And then joining us, we're going to learn about family businesses in Ohio and Columbus. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Family businesses play a unique role in the communities they serve. And with an uncertain job market, a younger generation is going to work for mom and dad in the family business. Of course, not all family businesses are like the one depicted in the TV show Succession. In that series about a fictional media empire, there is a significant strain on the family due to power struggles and conflicts over control of the company. But do some aspects of Succession mirror reality? Maybe. Still with us is Dave Specht, senior fellow at the Drucker School Global Family Business Institute at Claremont University. Thanks for sticking with us, Dave.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Joining us now to talk about family business here in Ohio is Jill Hoffmans, executive director of the Conway Center for Family Business in Columbus. Welcome to All Sides, Jill.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jill, the mission of your organization is to gather family business owners together and help them share knowledge and find support. When you were founded, was this an unmet need? Did local family businesses run kind of in a vacuum?
Well, sure. So just for context, there are about 60 family business centers throughout North America. At the time, Columbus did not have one. Our founders, there were several co-founders, two of whom were attorneys who worked a lot with families, and they were seeing a lot of the same themes, a lot of the same problems, a lot of the same sort of buy-sell agreements they were writing, and they were invited to Baylor to go to a family business conference. And from there, they said, oh my goodness, this is exactly what we need in Columbus. We need to get these family businesses together in an organized way to help them through some of these family business dynamics. Because, you know, working with your family, it's some of the people you love the most, but also the ones who can push your buttons the hardest.
Yes. So what work does the Conway Center for Family Business in tail. I looked at your website. It seems like you have seminars, you have lots of connection points. Tell me about what you do.
Sure. So the bulk of what we do is education, and everything we do keeps that family business dynamic at the forefront. So once a month, we do a broad topic at our educational program. Last week, it was on AI and the family business. Next month, it's on siblings and cousins working together. So those are higher level programs that appeal to a broad family business audience. From there, we have professional development programs on leadership development, next generation leaders, women in family business, succession planning. We do an HR roundtable because human resources, again, in a family business, those dynamics are at play. Mm-hmm. And then also what we do is C-suite peer groups, where we get them together once a month for 4 hours, where they issue process. So I'm sort of like the den mother as the facilitator, but these are CEOs of family businesses who come together to share the highs and lows and joys and sorrows and get business input and advice on personal and business matters, because that family and that business blurs a lot for them and they need that kind of support.
Yeah. If you were listening to the last segment, Dave talked about having courageous conversations.
Yes.
That's what he called it, where the family needs to talk about it. They need to have a plan of succession. They need to have the way to buy in and buy out. Is that something you teach?
Absolutely. Well, I don't know that we teach it, but we try to impress that upon them.
Yeah.
Any kind of conversation, critical or courageous, is difficult. And in families, it's exacerbated. I have one client where the brothers are best friends outside of work. And at work, one of the brothers wants to kill the other because he doesn't feel like he's pulling his weight or doing what he should or honoring the family credo. But so it's hard for him to have those conversations because he loves his brother. And outside of work, they're raising their kids together. And so it's hard. So we really emphasize, please have those conversations. And if you can't do it, we'll find you someone who can help you facilitate that.
Yeah. And Dave Specht from Claremont University, have you heard of organizations like this that kind of get family businesses together to help them learn from each other?
Absolutely. Jill mentioned family business centers. There's also, you know, the practitioners, I think, are developing these programs as well. Large CPA firms, wealth management companies are also coming alongside and trying to develop this sort of educational curriculum that allows their clients to be able to have these sorts of conversations and peer learning. So, yeah, I think there's definitely a movement in that direction. I think for the family business centers that are connected with universities, it's a nice kind of non-commercial place to have these conversations, and I think families appreciate that.
You were nodding about the non-commercial place.
Sure. That, yeah. So as Dave was talking about, like, you know, the wealth managers doing this curriculum, that's great. And I love any kind of education for our members, but I don't ever want them to feel captive by one. So we do have what we call service provider members who are really important to the work we do. They're the experts in the room. They can provide resources to our members, but really what happens in our programming is peer-to-peer. It's family business leaders, it's next gens, it's non-family leaders having a space without the, I don't want to say undue influence of commercial folks, but separating that, I think, is really important because, as you talked about earlier, family businesses are private. This is their money. It's not corporate money. It's their legacy money. It's their grandkids' money. They spend it very differently. They don't really want to talk about it. And so when you have your wealth manager in the room, sometimes it's hard to do that.
We talked earlier about how hard it is to study family businesses because they are private. I mean, do you have an idea of how many family-owned businesses are in Ohio?
So all of it's extrapolation from data. So you look at all of the businesses in the states, and then we do a percentage. So Ohio would be about 25% would be family-owned if we use the math that way. So a quarter of all business entities in Ohio would be family-owned, which means 33% of the population works in or with a family-owned business, which is a big number. So it would be 245,000 to 250,000 family-owned businesses in Ohio. So if you get that 25%.
Dave, do you have any numbers that can be nationwide that are similar to that? Or is it just, it's hard to come up with a number?
Yeah, it's hard to come up with a number. Actually, the number that Jill gave kind of surprised me. That's a little lower than I expected. But but if you look at numbers around the world, it truly is family-owned businesses that are, I would say more than half, but again, I don't have the numbers in front of me.
So the latest research is 59% in the U.S.
Okay,
which has come down. We used to say, you know, globally it's 80-90% are family owned or started as a family owned business. Mm. We used to say 62%. Now we're at 59%. That's the latest research that I was able to get my hands on are family owned. So yeah, Dave, more than half of U.S. business entities are family owned.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because it just seems like something that is hard to study, you know, like I don't know if you heard me mention the Wall Street Journal article. They cited a study where it was a payroll analysis where they looked for the name of an owner and if someone on the payroll had the same last name and that employee was under 30.
Right.
And I was just like, that's so.
Right. Because they're private.
Yeah.
It's so hard to study. So these numbers there's been a lot of family business research done and there's methodologies to it. And the landmark studies in the 90s were updated earlier. A few years ago. So that's the numbers we sort of play around with. The gold standard, which has been disputed and messed around with, but nobody's really been able to figure it out, is that 30% make it to the second gen, 12% to the third, and only 3% to the fourth plus generation. So that's a number we use a lot. And that would, calculating out using the 12% math, so that would mean there's like 30,000 businesses in Ohio that are third gen, which is pretty cool.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, let's talk about that different generational thing. So you see most of the time that if someone starts the business, their kids carry it on. But then when it gets to that grandkid piece and then the great grandkid piece, that's where maybe it doesn't necessarily stay in the family.
That's what the old research has told us. It's again, it's so hard to know what's what. A trend we're seeing more recently is that the second gen or third gen say, yeah, I want to be a part of the family business, but I don't want to do the widget. So you were talking earlier, like maybe this isn't a good fit for this kid to be in the business. They don't fit the business structure. So a lot of times now we're seeing the family business then spins off. Okay, well, you want to start a real estate company. We're going to use the original family business money from that. And this kid will be in real estate. This kid will have an IT company. This kid will have a lawn service, you know. Mm. So it still stays in the family business, but it's not the traditional family business succession plan that we are used to seeing.
Interesting. So it's like the Smith family companies who made widgets for a long time, but now the Smith family company also has a real estate component.
Right, with one of the kids in it or the cousins or the nephew. Yeah.
Yeah. And Dave Spector, have you seen that as well with businesses spinning off different components to keep their family in the business but change the business model?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, in the old data, I think it was assumed that, you know, that there was a closing of all these businesses. But oftentimes, if there's not an interest in the specific business, they would package the business, sell the business and pivot. So that happens all the time. And you're hearing the term family office a lot more these days, because this is how families organize themselves after the sale of an operating company. And so oftentimes, now the financial capital becomes the family business, and that may end up being invested in commercial real estate or in other companies. Many of these family offices in turn are making investments in other family businesses because they understand the nature of those family businesses. They also understand that those families oftentimes, when they get to the second and the third generation, they require capital to buy out disinterested heirs. And so there's a lot of interesting things going on with family capital at this moment.
When you mentioned the family office, can you explain a little bit more what that means?
Yeah. So a family office is basically, it's either organized within the family business and they're calling that like an embedded family office, but essentially it's the activities that are organized to take care of the family. So there's an investment arm, there may be tax person, there may be a someone with real estate expertise, and it's just the organizing function as these families get larger. But when they like to keep control of, of the data and things like that, oftentimes they're organizing themselves rather than externalizing, to a CPA or to a law firm. Many times they're organizing within and developing it as their own private family office.
Yeah, Jill, you were nodding at the family office phrase.
Yeah, so these are for
when
the
I think family
thing.
Office, I think just, everyone meeting in a room.
At the office.
Yeah, at the office.
No,
yeah.
These are really organized. This is for our high net worth family businesses. There'll be someone who manages the family office. There'll be a philanthropic arm, all sorts of, but it does. It keeps the family cohesive. It keeps the family, and oftentimes there are multiple business family business entities within that, keeps them all in control of the one family.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about keeping a business in the family with Dave Specht, Senior Fellow at the Drucker School Global Family Business Institute at Claremont University, also the author of the book, The Family Business Whisperer. And also with us is Jill Hoffmans, Executive Director of the Conway Center for Family Business in Columbus. Is there a secret to why some family businesses thrive over generations, where the fourth, fifth, even sixth generation stay in the business? Is there a secret to that, or is it just the way that family works?
Some will say good genes, but I don't know about that. Having lots of kids is a secret to success. It's communication. We go back to those critical conversations. It's communication. It's having the right people in the right seat, not putting junior in as the VP, as you talked about earlier, out the gate. It's having conversations about who are we as a family? What do we want to be as a family? It's those that go from mom and pop to being more professional and having a strategic plan and hiring and investing in consultants and coaches and making sure everybody's humming along is what I see.
And Dave Specht, have you been the family business whisperer, as your book is called, for a business that has survived past that third generation?
I have. And the secret is that there are few secrets. So they need great transparency. And again, these families that engage in courageous conversations about ownership, about management, about how to get into the business, how to get out of the business. All these families at some point need to trim the tree. So it can't just go out exponentially. Well, you think about it. If you have a founder, they build a business and it takes care of their family. And then if you have a couple of kids, then it's, already now needs to take care of two families. If you get out to the third and fourth generation, there needs to be some way to simplify ownership structure. And ultimately, the families that are transparent about how to do that and have processes in place, those are the families that survive. Also, families that really lean into innovation and continue to embrace change, those are the families that survive. It's not the family that does the same exact thing for three generations. It's the family that learns and continues to grow and continues to allocate resources towards innovation and pushing out into new areas.
Well, and Jill, you just even mentioned that recently you had an AI course, right? And so is that a part of it where you're trying to teach these family businesses how to keep up?
Right. Just awareness about how, doing the same, just because grandpa did it that way doesn't mean we have to do it that way. But those cause conflicts because grandpa might still be there and still might want to do it that way. And, that's hard. The younger generations coming in are so much more advanced in technology than even our Gen X generation is. So keeping up with that, so for us, because we have multi-generational folks who come to our programs, it's so the leading gens can see what's in the pipeline for technology and what their, next gens are actually talking about and how it applies to them and trying to make it less scary to the leading gens who may be resistant to that kind of change. So, yeah, we try to do that with all kinds of things.
Yeah. Are you seeing having to tell baby boomers that it's okay to let your grandkids change things and do it their own way, because it may seem scary, but maybe it's a good idea.
Right. I mean, and just because it's a family, doesn't mean it's any different than other business where there are generational shifts and conflicts within organizations, right? Mm-hmm. So every generation ahead says these kids these days. So we're always fighting that. But then with that lens of family dynamic over it, it's a lot harder. It's harder to tell grandpa, look, man, you don't know what you're doing and you're going to have to step out of the way than it is to, present to the board or a boss.
Yeah. And Dave, I have to think when you do coaching and all of that, you tell maybe the younger generation a different way of approaching the grandfather owner, rather than saying you're doing it wrong or that's, you know, so such an old school way. Is there a different way to approach that?
Yeah, grabbing grandpa by the shoulders and shaking him and telling him someday he's going to die is probably not the best approach.
Yeah.
But as I speak to the senior generation, I do have conversations about continuity versus control. And ultimately, if someone is telling me that what they really want is for this business to continue across generations, then they can't continue to control every part of that business. And so, you know, sometimes the conversations are challenging because they're talking out of both sides of their mouth. They say, we want this business to continue forever, but yet they have a death grip on the operation and are not letting others make decisions. And so sometimes it does take challenging the controlling owner to say, what do you really want? Do you really want to control this? Because if you do, then we can't continue to talk about continuity, because that's not what we're going to, that's not what's going to happen. So again, conversations that are not easy, but oftentimes a facilitator like myself is brought in so the family can throw rocks at me rather than throwing rocks at each other.
I had a client who had to fire his grandfather, like legitimately, to save the business. It was just, and he had to do it. They're now on their fifth gen, but still no Thanksgiving dinner. I mean, it's tragic.
That's sad.
Yeah. So it was the choice that the third gen had to make to save this legacy family business. And I mean, it was devastating.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk more about unique challenges for family businesses with Dave Specht and Jill Hoffmans. That's coming up on All Sides when we continue on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
Host Amy Juravich. Donato's, Reichert are just a few of the family businesses in the area. And according to the Conway Center for Family Business, located here in Columbus, there are over 32 million family businesses in the United States generating over $12 trillion in GDP. Still with us is Jill Hoffmans, Executive Director of the Conway Center for Family Business. Thanks for being here, Jill.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
And Dave Specht, Senior Fellow at the Drucker School Global Family Business Institute at Claremont University. Thanks for being here, Dave.
Thank you.
So, Jill, I was looking at the list of businesses who are part of your organization. Some of the names were very familiar, like Anthony Thomas Candy Company, Donato's Pizza, Schmidt's Sausage House. I picked all food-related businesses.
You sure did. So you can highlights see where, for children. Yeah.
You can see where my mind was at that moment. But is it easy? It's easy to know a family business when the business has a last name in it, right?
Sure.
But then there's lots of companies also on your list, you know, that I had no idea were a family business, right? Two Men in a Truck, mm-hmm. Sawmill Road Management Company, Ohio Steel Industries, IGS Energy. It's just interesting of how a business defines itself with like the name or versus a company name.
Oh, sure. Whose name's on the building?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's just dealer's choice, right? That's mm-hmm. up to the founders, how they want to identify themselves. But it is hard then to know who's who and what's what, especially family businesses are so prevalent that I used to tell my kids when I first started at the Conway Center, we'd be driving around. I'm like, that's a family business. That's a family business. And they're like, what? Mom, what are you talking about? I'm like, you shake a stick in Columbus, you'll find a family business.
Right. And Dave, is that something that you run into too, where people just assume family businesses are businesses with a last name on it?
Yeah, it's the and sons, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people just assume that, you know, it's it's a family business if the last name is on it. But as Jill was saying, you know, most companies, you know, are closely controlled or family owned. And so they don't always have the last names, but when they do have the last names on them, they're even more careful with the choices that they make, because the choices they make with the business reflect not only on the business, but they reflect on their family and the members of the family and how they show up in the community. So there's that element of transparency as well. That's unique to family business.
And Jill, your organization has awards that they give out for family businesses. I was looking up some of the awards from last year. The Family Business of the Year was awarded to Schmidt's Sausage House.
Indeed, yes. A very iconic, fifth run by the fifth generation family business. At our founding, the founders realized that it was really important to celebrate the accomplishments of family-owned businesses. Mm. Part of that is because people don't realize how many family businesses there are and the impact that they have on the economy. So highlighting them, whether they're 5 years in business, which is a feat in and of itself, or 160, we like to celebrate their longevity and those milestones. We also recognize folks who have implemented or have a succession plan in place, because that's really important. Family Business of the Year, Lifetime Achievement, those sorts of things.
Yeah, you gave Cityscapes and the National Sign System a succession planning award. Does that just mean that they created a good plan?
Yeah, so you have, so to win one of our awards, they have to apply, and we have a judging process and we look through. Yeah, they created a really robust plan that was very thoughtful about legacy, but also really forward looking, and theirs was really their application got really into the nitty-gritty about how they were going to do buy sells and how they were going to transition folks out. I mean, it's really, really impressive.
Yeah, and you gave a Lifetime Achievement Award to Charles Penzone, who everyone will know from Penzone Salons and Spas. I mean, that's a name that is just very well known in Columbus.
Absolutely. Chuck has won so many awards with the Conway Center for Family Business over the years, you know, from most recent Lifetime Achievement. They've won Family Business of the Year. They've won significant milestone awards too. Sure. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to pivot for a second to talk about minority-owned businesses. They may face a lot of challenges, including the ability to gain access to capital. Dave, do we know if keeping a business in the family is also a source of cultural as well as family pride? Do minority-owned businesses tend to struggle in this area?
I don't know if there's a specific struggle. I think it's a challenge for any family to keep a business in the family. I think from first to second generation is the first difficult transition. I'm doing some work outside of the United States in Uganda right now, and all, because of revolution, you know, and some cultural aspects of their businesses, they're really struggling to get to that third generation. So obviously every business needs access to capital. They need access to expertise like they would find at the Conway Center. So I think where families try to go it alone, especially when it's the first generation going to second, there's just no one's done it before. And so we shouldn't expect that business owners know how to do it. And so I think it's really crucial for especially those going first to second generation that they find peers that have done it, that have walked in their shoes and can sympathize and empathize with the challenge of not only the conversations, but giving up control and also planning for their own cash flows in their retirement. Because there's a lot that goes into thinking through a transition.
Yeah. And Jill, has your organization done work with minority-owned businesses? Do they have to approach things a little differently?
I think to Dave's point, like a business is a business and a family is a family. But I will say I just gave a talk on succession planning at the Women of Color Bold and Brilliant conference on Friday through the Women Business, the organization that certifies women-owned businesses, and this was their Women of Color group, and they had a panel on how diversity supplier, how do you do it? How do you pitch? How do you position yourself? Mm. Don't just say because you're a woman of color. Don't just say because you're a woman. You know, so not different, but maybe a few more challenges getting access to capital, being taken seriously in some communities. So I think there are some. It's hard for me to speak to as a white woman, but working with our members of color, there are some issues, I'm sure. To the point, I think, of is there more of a family connection or bond or impetus to go into and stay in the business? I don't know.
That would be anecdotal, I guess.
Every culture is different, right? Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if someone would be like have a harder time starting a business as a minority. I mean, maybe years and years and years ago, right? Like it's that generational thing where you have to, where you're building up the generational wealth.
Right. And the state of Ohio has great programs for MBEs and WBEs. So just, I think letting people, awareness around those programmings might be a challenge. But other than that, I think it's hard to speak to.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about keeping a business in the family with Dave Specht, senior fellow at the Durker School Global Family Business Institute at Claremont University. He's also the author of the book, The Family Business Whisperer, and Jill Hoffmans, executive director of the Conway Center for Family Business in Columbus. As an advisor, what service do you perform the most for a family-owned business, I guess? Or what's the most common question when people hire you? What are they desperate for?
Well, typically it's succession-related. Maybe they've tried to do it on their own, or they've tried to do it with advisors that they have. But it's really putting contingency plans in place for ownership and management. So not if someone dies, but when someone dies, like we need to change the language because none of us are going to escape this world without passing. So putting those contingency plans in place, having those conversations. Many times I'm brought in to facilitate family meetings where there isn't a pattern of generational conversations around the strategy for the business, how ownership will pass. And so oftentimes I'm brought in, at the intersection of the financial and the non-financial challenges of generational wealth.
Jill, is there a most common question you get when people come and join your organization?
So people who join usually for two reasons. One, there's pain around succession planning, to Dave's point. And the other is, how do we develop our next gens and their leadership and how they're going to enter into the business? One of the things I find as the facilitator of our C-level peer groups is since COVID, I've given out more referrals for coaching and therapy. People are struggling. Like it's hard. And I just feel like being able for folks to have access to resources like Dave or, you know, an advisor or even a therapist is a really important thing.
Yeah. In one of my earlier intros, I mentioned the TV show Succession, which took family business succession planning to a new level, a right. very dramatic level. Is that something that you as a family business coach, did you hate that show?
You know, I don't have TV, so I have not watched that show.
Oh.
I'm an outlier in that regard, but I've heard enough about it. So stereotypes sometimes exist for a reason. So we have family, you know, clients who the family don't speak to each other. The dad died and the siblings have been in court since. It's been like 7 years. And then we have ones that are just lovely and they have parties and traditions and passing the baton. So I wish I could. I should watch it. I should figure out how to watch it, but I have not.
Dave, what about you? Did you watch Succession and cringe, or did you enjoy it?
I've just seen snippets. I haven't watched it, but it does sound like they fan the flames of of some of the typical challenges that families face. And again, yeah, these are tough issues. When you mix business and family, there's going to be challenges. But I think it makes for great TV. I don't think every family business has all the same types of issues that are portrayed in Succession or in the reality TV shows. I mean, family business has become a reality TV show kind of magnet because of some of the challenges that can come up.
In the last 2 minutes we have left, I'm going to ask both of you to tell me what the biggest advantage is to keeping a business in the family. Dave, we'll start with you. What's the biggest bonus to having a family business exist and continue in the family?
One of the biggest advantages of having a family business and keeping it is it's a place where the family can rally around together. It's a shared purpose. And oftentimes when you see the family business get sold, families need to develop a new shared purpose. And sometimes they really struggle to do it. And so oftentimes it's that family company that is multi-generational that becomes a rallying point. It's a reason to get together. It's a reason to work together. It's a reason to struggle together. And it's a reason to hang in there and be resilient together.
And Jill, what about you? What's a big advantage of a family business?
I would say on top of that, the legacy piece, it's the history. It does bind the family, but it's also for our communities as well. You know, the best part is being an anchor in a community and a company that people can trust and have counted on for 100 years. I think that legacy piece is really important.
Are you seeing anyone come to you who has a brand new family business that they're starting?
Yeah.
Is that happening a lot?
Not a lot. I think Columbus has seen like a 3% increase in family business entities being formed, which is like top five in the country, which I find interesting. But yeah, it's fun and they're excited and scared. And yeah.
Yeah. And Dave, we have about 30 seconds left. Do you have new family businesses coming to you, or are you dealing mostly with legacy?
Most of the time they're coming to me when they're getting to the third generation, just because there's so much complexity. But the new ones, I think, have a great opportunity to set some patterns for themselves with how they communicate, how transparent they want to be. And so it's never too early to start to have these conversations if you're a startup or you're in your third generation. So I would highly recommend finding institutions like the Conway Center to be able to find peers and find best practices.
That's Dave Specht, Senior Fellow at the Durker School Global Family Business Institute at Claremont University. Thanks for being with us this hour, Dave.
Thank you.
And Jill Hoffman's Executive Director of the Conway Center for Family Business here in Columbus. Jill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Amy.
And this has been All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.